From WYPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. This week, we're examining the legacy of President Barack Obama. Today, a conversation with a journalist and an historian who have written about George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Bush and Clinton preceded Obama in office, but Obama's tenure in the White House has been unprecedented. How did Obama's governing style differ from his two closest predecessors? And how is the political landscape different 8 years after the nation's first African-American president took the oath of office? The Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian Taylor Branch wrote a groundbreaking book on Bill Clinton, whom he's known since the early 1970s. Michael Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated is a former national correspondent for The Washington Post who covered George W. Bush in the early years of the Obama administration. Taylor Branch and Michael Fletcher join me. We'll take your calls and comments about Barack Obama and the judgment of history. Midday starts right after this hour's headlines. And welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. Today, we are going to continue our week-long look at the Obama years and consider the legacy of the 44th president as he leaves office. My guests today are an historian and a journalist who have closely observed presidents for many years. In 2009, the historian Taylor Branch published The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. It chronicles an 8-year project in which he gathered a comprehensive oral history from Mr. Clinton as events unfolded during his presidency. Taylor Branch is perhaps best known for his landmark trilogy on the civil rights era, America in the King Years, considered the seminal work on the history of the civil rights movement. He won the Pulitzer Prize for the first volume of that trilogy, Parting the Waters. Mr. Branch, always a pleasure, sir. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Tom.
Journalist Michael Fletcher also joins us here in Studio A. He's a senior writer at The Undefeated, ESPN's online platform that explores the intersection of race, culture, and sports. Before joining The Undefeated, he was a national economics reporter for The Washington Post. Before that, he covered the Obama administration and the Bush White House, including Iraq war policy and efforts to restructure Social Security. He is co-author with Kevin Merida of the 2007 biography Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. And Mr. Fletcher, always a pleasure as well.
Good to be here.
Glad you're with us. You are welcome to join us as well here on Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. So let's talk a little bit about the governing style of Barack Obama. Taylor Branch, you spent a lot of time with Bill Clinton while he was in office. You did nearly 80 interviews with him, many of them late in the night, to help him gather information and keep a sort of oral diary for his memoir that he wrote. And then you took those occasions to write a recollection of it yourself. As you observe what President Obama has done in his time in office, how would you compare the two styles of governing?
Well, first of all, I would say that there's an overarching similarity between the two of them that I would express, that they were both trying to resurrect the belief that government of we the people can be a constructive force against a cynical age saying government's the problem. And that's what both of them wanted to do. How I would distinguish them is that Clinton took mostly a Will Rogers folksy approach. Let's take this problem and analyze it, folks, and show how we can solve it and move things forward. Whereas Obama took a higher, almost Madisonian constitutional approach, exemplified by his farewell address, where he's talking about what it means to believe in a government of we the people, and how that's every citizen's duty, and get out there and roll your sleeves up. We the people are responsible for it. It's not just so we had a really good constitutional law professor's more abstract approach, but I think they were both trying to do the same thing, as evidenced by the fact that Clinton failed and Obama succeeded in their first major effort to get national health care insurance. So I think they're both similar in the sense that they're trying to combat cynicism, accumulated cynicism for the last couple of generations about the capacities of government, but they had two fundamentally different styles.
So, Mike Fletcher, we've picked sort of Bush and Clinton to compare Obama to kind of randomly. I mean, the last 4 out of 5 presidents had two terms, Reagan, Clinton,
W. Bush, and, of course, President Obama. But you were in the Bush White House covering them. Are there any things that strike you as similar between the way they approached the job of the presidency?
Yeah, Bush and Obama. That's
it seems unlikely.
Yeah, it seems unlikely.
On its face,
I know. Yeah. I think they had, you know, distinctly different goals in terms of, you know, Bush talked about, you remember the days of the ownership society. It was kind of a continuation of sort of devolving some of the things from government to individuals. And so he sort of had that as a goal. But I think he, in his own way, you know, Bush had a lot of respect for the institution. Bush kind of had a formality about his, you know, sort of in his view of the presidency that I think he shares with President Obama. He never would talk in the voice of a constitutional law professor, of course. But I think, you know, in terms of sort of America as this kind of beacon, I mean, he was sort of big on that. And in some ways, I think, you know, Obama grew to sort of talk about that. You remember early on people talked about him not believing in American exceptionalism, and he kind of sort of backed away from that over time. So I think there was that kind of shared sense of kind of the greatness of America, if you will, and kind of the possibility of America in some ways.
Folks have observed, Taylor Branch, that Barack Obama came to the White House as an outsider. He had only been in the Senate for a few years. He was not particularly close to many of his colleagues in the Senate, by all reports, particularly even in the Congressional Black Caucus while he was in the Senate. And people have faulted him for not reaching out and being or at least giving a closer embrace to the Congressional Black Caucus while he was in office. In terms of the political skills of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, building consensus, building coalitions, getting stuff done, you mentioned that Obama had the success with health care where Mr. Clinton did not. But do you see other areas that compare either favorably or unfavorably?
Well, I don't know President Obama nearly as well. A few times I've seen him, he's very cordial, but not a hugging, not a backslapper. Clinton was more like Lyndon Johnson, and in fact, he even said on numerous occasions privately. He may have even said it in public. That for all of his wonkiness, you know, that he was he wanted to try to restore the capacity of government. He said, "No wonkish idea is worth a damn unless you can make a personal connection with somebody around that idea." And his biggest frustrations were like when he met John Zemin, the president of China, and he literally said, "I couldn't think of anything about his family, about what he liked to eat, you know, about how he looked. I couldn't make any personal connection." He refused to let me do that, and I knew then that all my proposals about political cooperation were worthless. So I think Clinton, and I don't know how Bush would fit between them, but I do think that President Obama is more personally aloof than Clinton. He is more of a cerebral president than a congenial social one.
Mike Fletcher, what do you think? That's a criticism that the Republicans have lobbed at Mr. Obama ever since he took office. You know, he doesn't play golf with me. He doesn't drink bourbon with me. I mean, is that a justifiable critique?
I think it is true. I mean, if Bill Clinton, if people said about him that he always made you feel like the most important person in the room, it could be perhaps said that Barack Obama doesn't know that you're in the room with him. I mean, he can be very aloof. I talked to a number of his golf partners, for example, and, you know, most people use that game as kind of a social lubricant. The president, when he plays golf, he wants to play golf, and he wants to play with his buddies and sort of have a good time at it, the same when he still played basketball at the White House. He would want to have a good game of basketball. He wouldn't really think in terms of, well, you know, does Paul Ryan play? Can we get him in, you know, and maybe give him a few buckets?
He saw it as a game, not a schmooze opportunity.
Exactly right. Yeah. But he also believed in the sort of, he is high-minded in the sense that, look, you know, we're doing business. There are good ideas on the table. Are they good or not? Bring a better idea, and we'll work with that idea on the table. So I don't see the need for kind of all the schmoozing and what have you, which I think ignores kind of the egos and things that are at play in Washington.
I mean, Taylor Branch, the intellectual rigor of Barack Obama does strike me as fairly similar to the intellectual rigor of Bill Clinton. George W. Bush, not known for his intellectual rigor, known for a lot of things, but not in that. A lot of supporters of Obama were very moved by Michiku Kukutani's piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago, where she talked books to Mr. Obama, and he was spouting off titles of things that he'd read and stuff that he'd given to his daughter and stuff that he could quote the first lines from. I mean, this is a highly literate man, a highly well-read man. People did fault him for perhaps being too professorial, but it's interesting, given his intellectual capacity, given his gift as an orator, there do seem to be some holes in his ability to communicate, as you're saying, to get that personal connection with people. I mean, people have faulted him for not selling health care and the ACA as well as it could have been sold, or not doing a number of things that could have been aided and abetted.
Well, I think that's fair, but you have to temper that by saying that his opposition from the day he entered the White House said that they weren't going to cooperate with him on anything. And they didn't say then, we're not going to cooperate with him because he doesn't invite us to play golf. They didn't care. They weren't going to cooperate with him no matter what. And so it's not sufficient to say that had he been more social or had he been more collegial, that he could have melted that refusal to cooperate, because that refusal to cooperate was a political stance based on principle that his positive ideas were harmful, that the idea of trying to rehabilitate big government, if you will, or the capacity of government through health care or anything else was the problem with America. So it was an entrenched divide there. And I think before we say any particular infelicity on the part of Obama was fatal, we have to recognize what he was up against. And I don't know whether a greater constitutional speech, or quite frankly, I think the only thing that would have moved this thing in his direction would have been a large-scale social movement. Where people are out in the streets wanting on climate change and other things, demanding that the government itself mobilize a positive response. And he didn't have that. He never had it. Politics is still a spectator sport in America.
Yeah, in the way that Lyndon Johnson had Martin Luther King, making it possible for him to make the political gains that he made. Mike Fletcher, there's a critique of the president that says he was a little too reticent, a little too shy, not willing to take the gloves off. One of the examples they cite is James Clyburn, the highly respected congressman from South Carolina, wanted to censure Joe Wilson, who is Mr. Clyburn's part of the congressional delegation in South Carolina. He was the one who interrupted President's State of the Union speech saying, "You lie." And Clyburn said, "You know, we need to really take action about this. We need to censure him. We need to show that this simply is not acceptable." And the president was reluctant to do that because he was trying to move health care through the...
Well, exactly. I mean, it kind of spoke to kind of the focus and kind of the discipline of Barack Obama. There were a lot of things that came up during his presidency that sort of had this racial edge to it, that he preferred just to let lie. You know, he didn't want to make an issue out of those things in order to sort of pursue his agenda, what he saw as a kind of the agenda for the people. So in the case of the Joe Wilson thing, Clyburn told me this himself, like, you know, Obama appealed to him and said, "Hey, you know, Jim, let this just drop, you know, so we can keep our eyes on the ball." And Clyburn, who grew up in a segregated South and probably felt more insult personally than I would argue than Obama did from the "you lie" thing. Obama is kind of, it's interesting how the racial arrows don't penetrate his armor. It feels like he kind of rises above that sort of thing. But Clyburn said, "No, we have to deal with this," and he did. And to me, that just kind of speaks to kind of Obama's view. I don't think he's reticent at all, but I think he puts his ideas on the table and wants to talk about them, talk about the merits of those ideas. And he doesn't like, I think in his mind, a lot of the salesmanship, a lot of the stuff that goes on in Washington, what people call being a good politician, I think to him feels like, you know, superfluous or, you know, just sort of unserious. And he wants to be serious about policy.
Most of the time when people describe him as incredibly calm, almost supernaturally calm, mm-hmm. and cool, Those can be encomiums, and they can also be harsh criticisms. Some folks say, let's, you know, forget the calm. Let's get a little crazy.
I know, but if you think about it, even reading his memoir and reading his kind of his policy manifesto, you know, The Audacity of Hope, he has an interesting capacity to observe his own life, right? I mean, the way he wrote about his mom, the way he writes about things that are very personal, it's a very dispassionate kind of view of one's life. And it's interesting because he's so analytical. He's such an effective writer and a clear thinker, but he does have that ability to sort of extract himself from the moment almost and observe the moment.
Michael Fletcher is a senior writer with The Undefeated, the online platform of ESPN that explores the intersection of race, sports, and culture. Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of many books, including The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement, and The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. You can join our conversation when we come back from a little break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. To give us a call, 410-662-8780. To drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. And to send us a tweet, our handle is @ Midday, Tom Hall. Stick around. We'll be back in a flash.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR. Where you're listening to Midday.
And welcome back, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the Worldwide Broadcast, we continue our examination of the legacy of Barack Obama with the author, commentator, and Georgetown professor Michael Eric Dyson. He joins me to talk about his latest book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. And on Thursday, I'll speak with Michael Days, an editor with the Philadelphia Daily News, about his new book, which offers an assessment of the Obama presidency. If you're just joining us today, we are talking about just that, the Obama presidency. My guests are Taylor Branch and Mike Fletcher. Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. Mike Fletcher, the senior writer with The Undefeated, which is ESPN's very interesting web platform that explores the intersection of race, culture, and sports. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780. midday@wipr.org is the email address, and @midday Tom Hall is our Twitter handle. Let's play a clip now of President Obama speaking about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, concerning his executive action to expand background checks in light of the, in particular, the Newtown shootings.
Our unalienable right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness, those rights were stripped from college kids in Blacksburg and Santa Barbara and from first graders in Newtown. First graders. Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad. And by the way, it happens on the streets of Chicago every day. All of us need to demand a Congress brave enough to stand up to the gun lobby's lies.
Well, so much for the argument that the president doesn't ever get passionate and doesn't, you know, make a heartfelt personal argument. We have those moments, Taylor Branch. We also have the fact that, for example, the president suggested, as the Constitution requires him to do, a replacement for Justice Antonin Scalia, Judge Merrick Garland. He did that in February of 2016, and then it just languished. And there are folks who said, you know, he should have really pushed, he should have done something to move the dial on that rather than just sort of accept defeat at the hands of Mitch McConnell.
I relate to the second more than the first. On gun control, to me, the passion that you heard in that speech came up against the fact that you can't really make progress and move the gun control. It's like redistricting until you acknowledge that there's a racial underpinning. And that's something that President Obama was not likely to do, because I think one of the hidden realities of his presidency was that every time race came to the surface, it hurt him. You know, I think all of his, no matter what he said, I think all of his advisors basically said, leave that alone. And I don't know how he could have how he could have done it otherwise. Now, on the Supreme Court nominee, that's probably right. I think the administration could have pounded the Congress for not doing its duty more diligently, recognizing it was going to be a long-term thing, rather than just let the issue fade away.
I mean, there are folks who said he should have just appointed him to the court and then let the lawsuits begin. You know, I mean, I don't know how that would have worked out, but people were identifying that as an option, saying, okay, he's on the court, now sue me.
I think that would have been probably the only thing he could have done. I mean, from my observation, he pounded him pretty good at the beginning, and the administration talked a lot about that. And this became one of the things people cited when, you know, people talked about the disrespect Obama faced from the Congress. So this became kind of another article in this indictment, if you will. But short of a recess appointment, I'm not sure what he could have done to sort of make this resonate. You know, Supreme Court appointments politically are interesting. They're so important. Politicians talk about them, but I'm not sure how much they resonate with the public. You know, the idea of, okay, I have a candidate for the Supreme Court, the Senate's refusing to even hold a hearing. It does somehow, unfortunately, you know, to Taylor's earlier point about people being spectators in our democracy, it does not move many people in my experience.
It might have moved Trump voters. I mean, Trump made more of a deal of it, it seems to me, than Secretary Clinton during the campaign. He even published a list of possible people he would nominate and talked about the court along with building the wall and repeal and replace and lock her up. It was it was part of the
I think he was in a certain position, though. You know, that gave him some, you know, some credibility among conservatives who trying to figure who were like everyone else trying to figure him out, you know. But I'm not sure that Hillary could have done kind of the mirror thing. I don't know that move would have paid any dividends for her at all.
I think a recess appointment also would have been very risky because it would have put the constitutional argument, given it to the Republicans, who really didn't have one, because they would have said, "You shouldn't." The spirit of the Constitution is that the appointee has to be confirmed by the Senate, and they would have sued and said that we are on the side of the Constitution. Whereas by not refusing to hold hearings, they could have been pounded on the notion that it's not an insult to me. Your conduct is an insult to the Constitution and to every American who needs to have a full Supreme Court. I think that would have been a wiser fight. But again, I don't know how long you could sustain that.
Let's talk about race and the significance, obviously, of the first African-American president. I mean, we all know that Mr. Obama's obituary, the first line is going to be he was the first black president. You've both written and thought a lot about race. As a springboard for that, let's listen to the president's remarks following the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the trial regarding the death of Trayvon Martin.
When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me. The African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that doesn't go away. You know, there are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me.
Mike Fletcher, Ta-Nehisi Coates, in his piece in The Atlantic about President Obama, said that his existence inflamed racists' conscience, but it also expanded the country's anti-racist imagination. Do you buy that analysis?
I'm not sure, because I haven't thought deeply enough about that, but I do know that his presidency surfaced a lot of racism that I think still existed, always existed out there. People say it grew it, but I don't think it grew it, but I think it brought it to the fore. And just by the mere fact that the president was black, the minute he invoked race, the minute he talked about this, you know, kind of created a frenzy. We all remember during his first term when he very casually and carefully, it felt like, talked about the arrest of Skip Gates, the Harvard professor, and said that the Cambridge police had acted stupidly in arresting him because they thought he was breaking into his own home. There had been a call, you know, to the police. And it felt like a very careful, nuanced, not particularly controversial thing. And it blew up. It became this huge kerfuffle. that led to this crazy beer summit
yeah, and all of that. And Mr. Gates.
And the other thing it led to is Obama's aides talking to him about, you know, not talking about race. And there have been academic studies that sort of looked at this. Apparently, during his first term, the president talked about race than any Democrat, I think, since Kennedy. Maybe it was before Kennedy. I can't remember the exact time, but in a long time. And that was no accident. I mean, clearly race came up later in the second term. You know, the police shootings, the Black Lives Matter movement, Trayvon, these things kind of forced Obama onto that playing field. But it's something he tried to avoid because it was like a losing game for him.
Mike Fletcher from ESPN's The Undefeated. Taylor Branch is here as well. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Taylor Branch, if Barack Obama didn't talk about race as much as folks would have wanted him to, at least in the first term, a lot of folks have noted that he's been talking about it a lot more in recent weeks. Race is certainly on the top of people's minds as we anticipate the inauguration of Mr. Trump in just a couple of days. He has this Twitter feud going with John Lewis, the iconic leader of the civil rights movement. What do you make of that? And what do you make of the Democrats' reaction to that, Mr. Lewis? And now I think it's close to 30 people in Congress deciding not to attend the inauguration. I'll note that Mr. Lewis also did not attend the inauguration of George W. Bush, whose presidency he also thought illegitimate because of the concerns about the vote count in Florida and the Supreme Court decision.
Well, that's a lot. I mean, on the issue of Obama's legacy and race, I think we need to bear in mind that he hadn't even left office yet, and his legacy is probably something that we should talk about in 20 years. And I think
like a true historian.
No, but predict that in 20 years, my prediction is that it's going to be the non-racial component of the first black presidency that is going to be most important in making the great mass of Americans more comfortable with having a black president. The fact that he didn't racialize the presidency, that he spoke like the president of all the people, that he maintained that discipline, even in a lot of racial issues. Not that he ran from his principles, you heard them there, but he didn't pound people over the head with race to a fault. It's going to be very hard for somebody to argue what they might have argued before, which is that any black president is going to hurt the country by overemphasizing race and showing that they can't do the job. He certainly did the job. I mean, all of these things that are subtle and beneath the surface in a racialized country, he did an awful lot to heal in a long-term way, I think.
Mike Fletcher, Bill Clinton had planned to form a commission on race, headed by John Hope Franklin, another esteemed scholar and black historian. And that all got derailed by the Lewinsky scandal. So people saw that as one of many missed opportunities in Clinton's presidency when he got mired in, you know, Lewinsky and the impeachment and all that stuff. Did Barack Obama miss opportunities here in terms of given his personal life story and what he could bring to the table about the conversation about race?
You know, a lot of people argue that, and I talk to a lot of black progressives who say, for example, that the president should have had a targeted black agenda. But I think if you think about the reality of kind of the political realities that the president faced, I don't think there was a missed opportunity. I think, you know, the president would often say, you know, I'm the president, not of black America, but of the United States of America. And I think that was a real thing. And he doesn't have a lot of patience, that, by the way, for conversations about race. I mean, he wants to do something about race, and he wants to make policy that he thinks will, you know, lift the dispossessed. And he would argue they're disproportionately black and brown, you know, like his health care reform disproportionately helped those people, saving auto manufacturing jobs, you know, helps disproportionately African-Americans and generally working-class people. So he's kind of a man of action in that way. I think the rhetoric of race, I think, kind of makes him a little weary. I get that sense because it becomes a circular conversation. I remember covering a number of those panels that the Bill Clinton's race commission held around the country. And, you know, it was just a kind of, you know, it was kind of what we hear all the time. You know, people say we need to talk about race, but mainly our conversations about race end up with us talking past one another. You can't get that acknowledgement of the reality, the grain of reality in someone's statement. So I think President Obama recognizes that and chose to kind of, he's pragmatic, you know, work kind of within the confines of what's doable and possible. And I bet you he would argue that a conversation about race is just that, a conversation.
You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1 WIPR. Let's go to the phones now. Hilda from Frederick. Welcome to Midday with Taylor Branch and Mike Fletcher.
I guess I want to say that Mr. Obama brought family back to our country. And that's what I will remember him most for. I was born in a big family. We honored black and white. I've held hands with black people. It doesn't matter to me. And I just think Mr. Obama was a family man, and he brought it back. And I'm grateful to him for that.
Well, thank you for your call, Hilda. I appreciate it. The example, Taylor Branch, of the Obama family, Michelle Obama, in so many ways redefining the role of the First Lady. We talked a bit about this yesterday with our guest yesterday, Sherry Parks and E.R. Shipp. It was certainly a blemish-free presidency when it comes to scandal and that kind of stuff.
I think the caller's comment is fair in the sense that there was more of a family balance about Obama than there was for the Bushes or even for the Clintons, for that matter. Hillary was there for her policy initiatives, and Chelsea was there mostly because they kept her in the background and protected her. But the Obamas, Michelle and the two daughters, were kind of in better proportion as a family when you saw them, without any political flaws, and they weren't trying to make political points with them, but they just were a visible, functional family. So I think in that sense, the callers, I can't think of a presidential family where there was that much of a balance between the president as husband and father and his political roles.
And Mike Fletcher, you wrote about this 8 or 9 months ago about the kind of unstated rules regarding people's public respect for the president of the United States and mm-hmm. his or her family have shifted. They have changed. It's different. It is a much more coarse and vulgar environment than any other president has had to
I know, unfortunately, right? And it feels like a lot of that coarse behavior is now kind of part of the normal political give and take. We've heard some very ugly things said about the First Lady in the wake of Trump's election and even leading up to that. But one thing that's been so admirable about the Obamas is that they don't rise to debate. You know, you remember Michelle Obama's kind of now famous quote, you know, like, when they go low, you know, we go high. And I think that's been a great example for the country, because they sort of get into the, you know, the mosh pit of, you know, insult and, you know, insult back. It doesn't lead us anywhere.
Mike Fletcher of ESPN's The Undefeated is the author with Kevin Merida of Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. He covered, among many other things, the Bush White House and the Obama administration. Taylor Branch is here as well. He chronicled the Clinton White House in a groundbreaking book called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. You are welcome to join our conversation as we continue our 4-day assessment of the presidency of President Barack Obama. You can join us at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
My president is black, in fact, he's half white. So even in a racist mind, he's half right. If you have a racist mind, you be aight. My president is black, but his house is all white. Rosa Parks sat so Martin Luther could walk. Martin Luther walked so Barack Obama could run. Barack Obama ran so all the children could fly. So I'ma spread my wings, you can meet me in the sky.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. This week we're talking about the legacy of Barack Obama. Tomorrow my guest will be the author and political commentator Michael Eric Dyson. He published a book last year called The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America. Dr. Dyson is also an ordained Baptist minister, and his latest book is organized in the form of a church service. It's called Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. It's very provocative and powerful, and I'm looking forward to speaking with him about it tomorrow, and I hope you can join us. Today, if you've just joined us, my guests are Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, and Michael Fletcher, a senior writer for the undefeated ESPN's platform that explores the intersection of race, culture, and sports. Let's go to the phones. Sam in Annapolis, welcome to Midday with Taylor Branch and Mike Fletcher.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you? It's interesting that someone's there from ESPN. I'm thinking in terms of the parallels between the experience of Jackie Robinson and that of Barack Obama. In both cases, neither of them set out to make it a racial issue. They just tried to do the best they could in their parallel professions, and yet they brought out all the racist bile that was out there. And nonetheless, in the case of Jackie Robinson and ultimately in the case of Barack Obama, it will be a long-term healing. I think in a more poetical way, that's what the quote by Ta-Nehisi Coates that you read earlier is saying, that short-term, yeah, all the racist bile, long-term, it will be a salutary effect on the country.
Well, thanks for your call, Sam. I appreciate it. Mike Fletcher, your reaction?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. It's interesting thinking about Jackie Robinson, kind of his temperament, and that of Barack Obama. Jackie, I think, certainly burned hotter, right? He was a kind of hotter personality, but basically faced the same challenge. You know, you're a racial pioneer. You're in this job. The world is scrutinizing you in ways fair and unfair. You know, in Obama's case, even in both cases, African-Americans have expectations of you. Some whites have suspicions of you. And I think they both performed admirably. You could argue about this or that policy, obviously, with Barack Obama. Should he have been, more aggressive on A, B, or C? Should he have been warmer towards members of Congress? But I don't think anyone's going to be able to argue that he didn't execute the office of the presidency with dignity and class and intelligence. And I think at the end of the day, that will stand regardless of what, you know, how people try to defile that, how people try to skew that, how people try to spin that into being something else. I think those facts will stand and ultimately help our country.
Taylor Branch, when it comes to the president's capacity, any president's capacity to bring the country together, obviously Barack Obama launched his political career talking about unity in 2004 at the convention in which John Kerry was nominated, talked about it all through his both of his runs for office in 2008 and 2012. Jonah Goldberg, a conservative essayist and writer, published an essay today that says that the presidency has become ill-suited to the task of unifying the country because the presidency has become the biggest prize and totem in the culture war. That's an interesting take, I think. Is it possible for any president, regardless of race, gender, et cetera, to in fact bring the country together in a way that perhaps an FDR was able to do it or presidents in generations past?
Well, I think the quote is nonsense. We've always had culture wars, and Abraham Lincoln brought the country together in the midst of tremendous culture wars. And think of even Obama in this respect. When he came into office, he himself was uncomfortable with civil union, which was the euphemism for being for gay rights. By the end of his presidency, he endorsed full-throated marriage equality, and the polls are very high, and that was accomplished in spite of the culture wars because there was a large-scale public movement in that direction that has been going for generations now. And the president wasn't the leader of it, but he kind of blessed it and helped it forward, and the NAACP did too. So it's not that nothing can happen and that culture wars paralyze everything. Almost unimaginable gains have occurred in some areas, including marriage equality. But it's because there was large-scale social movement and support that's been generated for a long time. So he didn't start it. He didn't create it. In many respects, he was helpless in areas where there wasn't a large-scale social movement, including gun rights, where there's one percolating around. But it hasn't yet solidified around a particular goal and something that the country can rally toward.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guests this afternoon, Taylor Branch and Mike Fletcher. We're talking about the legacy of President Barack Obama. 410-662-8780 is our telephone number. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Libby in Towson, welcome to Midday with Mike Fletcher and Taylor Branch.
Hi, thank you. This week, the New York Times ran a very interesting article about the books that have shaped President Obama and that he has turned to during the course of his time as president. And there's a very interesting quote in which he said that he turned to books as a young man to raise himself as a black man in America and to teach himself how to become a black man. And I think that's very interesting, and I think it points to his commitment to learning and his intellectual capacity. And I think we should remember that President Obama, our first African-American president, was not actually raised day-to-day by his black relatives. His father, of course, was distant, and he was raised by mostly his white mother and her family. And he turned to books to basically raise himself as a black man. And I found that fascinating. It's a really great piece in the New York Times this week.
It is indeed. It's written by the book critic for the Times, Michiko Kukutani. Thank you for your call, Libby. I appreciate it. Jay sends us an email saying it's a different time and a different man, but I think Teddy Roosevelt is another great example of the president and husband and father. That's an interesting observation. Bob sends us an email and says, I can appreciate the fact that President Obama is recognized as the first black president. Do you think he could have emphasized that his mother is white to deflect the racial backlash that he's faced over these past 8 years? I realize that a bigoted person would still say he's black, even though he is biracial. I don't know, Mike, how does that strike you? Is that going to matter one way or the other?
Yeah, I don't think that would matter much. And the reality of race, right, in our country, it's a question of kind of self-identification. And Barack Obama has always sort of seen himself as a black man, even though obviously he's biracial. So I don't know. And I think people know his mother's white. I don't think that would have mattered.
Well, I think it would have made it worse. When you raise raise race, no matter how you do it, people are going to jump in. They're going to say, gosh, he's de-emphasizing. He's running from the fact that he's black. You know, it would have blown up right in his face.
You know, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. I guess he's in. I mean, he has certainly. I mean, I guess it was Coates who said for the past 8 years he's been walking on ice and he never fell.
Yeah, exactly.
So, which I thought was an interesting observation. David in Baltimore, thanks for your call to Midday with Taylor Branch and Mike Fletcher.
Good afternoon. I'm kind of echoing what a couple callers ahead talked about, and I have to say, initially, the first 4 years I was disappointed in the president because it seemed to me as they were disrespecting him, and he always kept the upper lip. He always stayed above the fray. I really wanted him to kind of go back at him, and then I thought about, when I was a child and I saw the Jackie Robinson story, and that made me think in a whole different way. He's the first African-American to hold this office. He's thinking 50, 100 years from now, what that'll say to the next generation or the next person who can come up through the ranks. So I think he actually played it pretty smart. He played chess. They were playing checkers, and he was playing chess. So, you know, it gained a new respect from me about the president. That's my comment.
Thank you, David. I appreciate the call, and I love that formulation. He was playing chess while everybody else was playing checkers. You know? And, you know, time will tell. As you say, Taylor, maybe in 20 years we'll know who won. I'm interested in this notion of Obama's incredible optimism. He seems to be considerably more optimistic about the future than many of the people on the progressive left who were such ardent supporters of him. I wonder what he would define or how we all should define success. He said, for example, when he met with Mr. Trump for the first time after the election, that if Mr. Trump succeeds, the country succeeds. What does that mean? Does that mean if Mr. Trump builds his wall and repeals the ACA and locks her up, he will have, you know, the country will succeed? How, what do you think the metrics for success are in this day and age?
I mean, those words he spoke with Mr. Trump, you have to wonder, you know, how deeply felt they were. But I would say that, you know, to the degree that, you know, that the president believes that President-elect Trump wants to protect Social Security, strengthen Medicare, wants to create jobs in this country, you know, unlike any president that God has ever created, whatever his, Trump's quote was. If he can do that, then, hey, that would be good for America. I think that's what President Obama means in that moment. And why get into, like, the plausibility of President-elect Trump's plans? It's just not a hopeful thing. The president, and I have to add, I think his optimism is authentic. You know, people think he's saying this, he's holding something back. I don't get that sense whatsoever. I think it's an honest view of his. Think about his own story.
Yeah.
How improbable was that? You could have had me on the show in 2006 and said, when will you see a black president, Mike Fletcher? I would have said, I have no idea. You know, I would maybe argue that's not possible. You know, who knows? And if so, what would he look like? I would have said maybe he would be a former military man. You know, something like that.
Colin Powell.
Exactly. I wouldn't have envisioned Barack Obama, even after his, you know, I knew who he was after the speech. But I didn't think that would be enough to catapult him. But here we are, you know, sitting here talking about his legacy.
Yeah. And Taylor Branch, when it comes to these mass movements that give the president the imprimatur to do things, Michelle Obama talked to Oprah Winfrey a few days ago and said, now we're feeling what not having hope feels like. So there is this clear sense of deflation among people on the left. Do you think that can serve as an animating force to catalyze people and get people sort of off the couch onto the streets and making a ruckus for what they believe in?
Well, that's basically a question of are you an optimist or not? Because a pessimist would say if we're not catalyzed by all the things that have happened and the constant deaths and shootings and Charleston, South Carolina will never be catalyzed. On the other hand, you can say there's an awful lot of the 1950s were seen as a dead time, but there was a lot of percolation that took hold when social movements kind of congealed in the 1960s. So I think that it could. That's the role of an optimist. And I think when President Obama said, if the president is successful, America's successful, basically he's saying, if Trump can leave office in 4 years from now and the people will approve what he did, then America's successful. I don't think that he can do a lot of the things that he's threatening to do and even pledged to do and be a successful president, because I think it's going to blow up in his face and it wouldn't make him a successful president.
JC from Pasadena sends us an email. I'd say Lincoln brought half of the country together as the other half was in rebellion, and perhaps much the same divide exists today. It's an interesting thing. Perhaps the divisions are just as acute as they were in the 1850s. Who knows? Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I appreciate both of you guys coming by, and we will certainly be in touch with you as the Trump presidency unfolds. Appreciate it. Historian Taylor Branch is the author of the 2009 memoir, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, based on an 8-year project in which he had 79 candid and lengthy conversations with President Bill Clinton. Taylor Branch is also the author of a landmark trilogy on the civil rights era and a collection called The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Michael Fletcher is a senior writer at The Undefeated. That's ESPN's online platform that explores the intersection of race, culture, and sports. Before joining The Undefeated, Mike was a national correspondent and economics reporter for The Washington Post. He's the co-author of the 2007 biography, Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. On our website, you can find links to more by Taylor Branch and Michael Fletcher. Come to WIPR.org. /midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, author, commentator, and Georgetown professor Michael Eric Dyson joins me to talk about his latest book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Hope you can join us for that. And I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for today's guest. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of the entire Midday team, appreciate your listening. Have a great day.